Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in the hour, the Free Roaming Horses of Eastern Kentucky. And at the Heedley Whitney Museum of Art in Lexington, a dual exhibition of two celebrated Kentucky artists and longtime friends, Lynn Sweet and Rodney Hatfield. First, immigration in Kentucky in the spring of 2026. Many immigrant families across the Commonwealth, among them many who build things, move things, clean things, serve things, are living with fear over ICE raids, detention, and deportation. Kentucky State Representative Nima Kulkarni is also an immigration employment attorney and founder and executive director of the New Americans Initiative. She joins us to talk not just about policy, but about lived reality and about the gap between how immigration is often discussed in politics and media and how it's experienced in communities where the stakes are immediate and personal. Welcome, Nima.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So when you look at immigrant life in Kentucky right now, what feels most urgent to say first?
I think the most important thing that people need to realize is how pervasive the atmosphere of fear has been since this administration took office and since it implemented the many, many policies that it has directed really at targeting and criminalizing and deporting as many immigrants as they could. Early on, the focus was ostensibly on just the worst of the worst, on violent criminals, on human traffickers, on drug smugglers. And it has quickly become apparent, and it was apparent starting last year, that the focus was not on those individuals and that people who have committed no crimes are being rounded up. People that may have had lawful status are being rounded up. People that are trying to do things the right way have been picked up, detained, and deported. So that atmosphere of anxiety, uncertainty, and fear is very pervasive. It is in every sector, every industry, every community that you can think of. And it's something that I think people don't really understand the economic or societal impact of just yet.
Things seem to have gone a little quiet. Is that an accurate perception?
It is a perception. That is true. I think one of the things that people don't realize as well is that this administration has changed tactics multiple times. And they've done that in response to public pressure, public opinion, polling, approval ratings, things like that, because this is, at the end of the day, a political machine, and they are using immigrants and immigration as political pawns, as they have been used for many decades across administrations. But yes, it is a deceptive perception, because while they may not be focusing on the sort of shock and awe style raids that we saw early on in Chicago and California, and especially in Minnesota, what we are seeing is that the continuation of people being taken into custody, into detention is happening. It's happening in more quiet places. It's happening in more rural places. So we may not see it in Lexington or Louisville, but it is happening in our smaller counties and our more rural counties, and we're not hearing about them. And they are utilizing local jails. They're utilizing local law enforcement to make sure that they can pick up, and I mean ICE or the Federal Immigration Enforcement Agencies that have been deployed for the sole purpose of immigration enforcement at this point. And so they are able to pick them up from local jails without any of the due process considerations that we might think of. And those were already considerably less for non-citizens of the United States, even though they have the same rights under the Constitution. And so you do have the right to remain silent. You do have the right to be in front of an immigration judge. You don't have some of the due process rights that we would think of in our criminal justice system, like the right to an attorney, the right to a speedy trial, the right to a phone call. None of those apply. And so we are taking essentially a civil violation, a paperwork violation, and have built an entire criminalized, militarized apparatus around that paperwork violation, which is civil, in order to remove as many immigrants as we possibly can from the United States. So it is happening. They have changed tactics again because they saw the backlash in Minnesota. I mean, that was the last straw for a lot of people. And it resulted in the deaths of two U.S. citizens in public on the streets who are not violating any laws, who are not committing any crimes, no matter how many times our federal immigration enforcement agencies tried to say they were under attack. Video footage, photo footage, any witness testimony has disproved that in court. And so what we need to understand is this administration is not above lying directly to the people of the United States. They're not above lying directly to judges. And so we need to make sure that we are vigilant about what is happening in our own communities, because it is continuing to happen.
Well, we are talking immigration here, so because of that, we have to talk in racial and ethnic terms. And for many white, highly educated people in media and in politics, immigration enforcement can be an argument, a headline, a debate. For many Latinos and other people of color, it can shape where you drive, whether you report a crime, whether you show up for work, maybe even whether you open the door. How do you want listeners who are insulated from that fear to understand the difference?
That's a really great question, because people feel safe until they're not. And I think a lot of people, even in the immigrant community, felt safe because, for instance, they weren't criminals. They didn't come from the countries that were being targeted. They were in a different socioeconomic bracket. And so they felt insulated and they felt safe and they felt secure because they pay taxes. They've built a life here. They're law-abiding residents of the cities and the states and the communities in which they live. But what, again, I think quickly became apparent is that this administration does not care about any of that. There's a lot of window dressing about we're going after the worst of the worst. But what I think people need to understand, especially who are not Black or brown, is that the erosion of civil rights, the erosion of human rights, the erosion of due process, the expansion of the surveillance technology and the tools that are being used are directed at everybody. It has nothing to do with immigrants. It doesn't matter if you're white or you're Black or you're brown. These tools are being used against everybody at this point. All of our data is being shared at Social Security Administration, the IRS, all our tax data. Everything is being shared with the federal agencies that are purporting to use them just for federal immigration enforcement purposes. That data sharing happened early on. So they have all of our information, whether or not we're citizens, whether or not we come from countries that are being specifically targeted or named. And I think that needs to be understood. There's a historical context to all of this. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, didn't exist before the Patriot Act, which restructured Department of Homeland Security. And that expansion at that point for surveillance and technology that was being used against citizens, it had nothing to do with immigration at that point. It was about anti-terrorism. Those tools continued to exist. Those tools continued to be expanded and used. And now we are giving our government even greater license to use those tools against us, even though the us we're thinking is someone other, right? Someone who's an immigrant, someone who's a non-citizen. They're all being used against us. We are all in the same boat when it comes to protecting our democracy, when it comes to fundamentally safeguarding our liberties, our rights, and our privileges. And if we are to safeguard America as a beacon of hope and freedom in this world.
Recent reporting has found deportations and arrests by Kentucky-based ICE operations have gone up, and a large majority of those arrested have already been deported. What does the threat of a raid or a detention do to a household beyond the immediate legal consequences?
What we are seeing are people who are not going to work, who are not going to school, who are not going to the grocery store because they're afraid to step foot outside their house. As the executive director of New Americans Initiative, most of what we have been doing, in addition to trying to stabilize the immigration status of those individuals that are eligible for green cards or for citizenship, is also to let them know what their rights and their obligations are under the law, because those laws are being ignored many times by our government, by our own agencies and the officers that are being deployed to implement those laws. It is a real inflection point in our country's history. This has never happened before. It's been unprecedented that administrations don't honor the institutions of democracy, our judiciary, our legislative branch, the limitations and the checks and balances on the executive, because our founding fathers did not want tyranny. Their fundamental goal in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, was to make sure that we do not end up like governments that are under dictatorships, that are under tyrannical rule. And we have forgotten that. I think we have become complacent over the decades because we expect that these democratic institutions, these principles, these norms that we all grew up with generation after generation are just going to be there when we wake up the next day. And what is going to happen is that we're going to wake up and they're going to be gone. And once they're gone, they're not going to come back.
Well, if conversations like this one inspires us Kentuckians to think about what kind of commonwealth we want this to be, we want to live in, what's the real question here? How aggressively we enforce or how honestly we define who belongs?
I think honesty is the key there, Tom. I think we need to understand, I mentioned that we were at an inflection point before, not only in our constitutional norms, I think we're at an inflection point about who we think of ourselves as Americans. Who do we think about when we think about citizens of the United States? Who do we want to be citizens of the United States? And that is something that we've grappled with almost since the inception of this country. There have been periods of restriction. There have been periods of expansion. But I will say, I mean, even if you don't care about immigration as an issue, you don't care about immigrants or refugees or any of that, this is not an issue that has touched you even by this point. Think about the economic impact of what is happening here. In Kentucky alone, immigrants represent 16% of our physicians. They represent a significant portion, 13% of our small business owners. They are an economic imperative in Kentucky, for our agriculture community, for our tourism community, our hospitality community, the industries that we think about, keeping the economy of Kentucky going. So the economic argument is there. The numbers are there. If we lose people with this sort of wide net of not caring about who we are catching in that net, we're not worried about if they're criminals, we're not worried about if they violated immigration laws, or if they were just suddenly deemed illegally present in the United States after they'd been living here for years on a particular basis, a temporary basis or a humanitarian basis, we're taking away their rights as well. And we're taking away their contributions to our economy. That conversation gets lost as well. So it's a cultural question. It's an economic question. And it really is a question about, are we going to continue to be a free and fair democracy? And that word means a lot of different things to a lot of people. But at the core of it, it's about the freedom to be who you can be. It's the opportunity to be who you can be, what you work towards being, without being singled out or discriminated against for your race, for your gender, for your ethnicity, for your age. It is crucial that we maintain that basic level of understanding that the idea of America is about freedom. And if we're in the business of taking freedom away from people who are trying to provide for their families and their communities, then this is not an America that I recognize. And increasingly, it is not an America that other people, other citizens around this country recognize. And we have opportunities to change it through our vote. At this point, it is the only thing we have left. I think we have seen Congress abdicate its responsibility to be a check on the executive. So it is incumbent on us to be vigilant. It's incumbent on us to show up where we can for our communities. And that goes beyond showing up to rallies. That goes beyond showing up for our church members during service. It goes beyond all of that. We have to prove to each other who we want to be as Americans. And we have opportunities this year. We will have opportunities in the years to come. But it is something that we're going to have to decide soon if we're going to maintain our place in the world as a democracy.
Nima Kulkarni is a Kentucky state legislator, an immigration employment attorney, and founder of the New Americans Initiative. And thank you for coming back and joining us again, Nima.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
At 7 p.m. on May 28th at the Kentucky Theater, a discussion for the Times will take up the economic and political forces behind Latin American migration and the many narratives out there shaping public perceptions. If you go, you'll hear a conversation among a panel of leaders from academia, advocacy, law, and the arts, talking about the socioeconomic and political drivers of Latin American migration, as well as integration, cultural identity, and immigration reform. The event is sponsored by the Casa de la Cultura de Kentucky in partnership with Bluegrass Community Foundation and Press Forward Bluegrass. And here to give us a preview is Fatima Espinosa Vasquez, assistant professor in the School of Information Science at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Fatima.
Thank you, Tom. Very nice to be here.
So when people hear that phrase, Latin American migration, what do you most want them to understand that's often missing maybe from public conversation?
I think the most pressing thing for me at this point to clarify, I suppose, would be that immigrants are not a monolith. Immigration is not this just one single event. It's a very complicated process. And then in terms of immigrants, we come in all kinds of colors, with different origins, with different circumstances, some of us more privileged than others, and with a big variety of challenges and struggles. So each story is different. The path that each of us take to get here is very different. Even within families, we have different stories and different status. And so I think what changes for immigration and for immigrants is the circumstances that brought us where we are, right? The factors that made us make a decision to migrate, and then also the possibilities that we had at hand in the moment to be able to do so. So the reasons people migrate, particularly from Latin America, are very complex, right? And it's a combination of circumstances, personal needs, goals, and social structures, institutions, regulations, economic, the social circumstances. So even though it's very easy for us to cluster immigrants and immigration into this one phenomenon and this one category, it is important for us to acknowledge that each case is very, very different.
The panel is going to focus on both socioeconomic and political drivers, as I mentioned. And I'm just wondering, in your view, what are the biggest forces pushing people to leave home right now?
From my perspective as a scholar who studies crisis, right, in different contexts, and information technology, what I see is an overarching theme of a crisis caused by either political unrest or economic instability. And these crises are usually caused by local and international policies. So we would need to look at each country specifically, look at the events, the recent events and the historical events that had brought up these political and economic hardships. So for example, in the case of Honduras, which it's where I come from, is when where I've done some of my research as well. There was a surge of migration and asylum seekers to the United States between 2017 and 2019. I think many of us can remember that, right? And this surge was a long-term consequence of the 2009 coup d'etat in Honduras and the series of electoral crises that follow the instability that the coup d'etat caused. Also, if we look at the history of Honduras and the long history of U.S. political and economic intervention, that would also help explain, right, why the country has not been able to have a stable political system. So usually all these crises are caused by crises that are structural. And it turns into this vicious cycle of dependence, right, and crisis and dependence and intervention and so forth. So we would need to look at each particular case. Overall, it's crisis, like the one in Colombia caused by paramilitarism, like the one that forced many campesinos come from Mexico due to NAFTA, like the one caused by Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, right? So a different bunch of crises across Latin America.
Well, from your perspective, Fatima, how do public narratives about migration shape the way that communities respond to newcomers?
So it's huge. The public narratives that are floating right now are very, very powerful, to the point where people who have, you know, Christian, democratic, and even liberal values are speaking in dehumanizing ways about immigrants. This is something that, as an immigrant myself, living for the last 20 years in this country, I never thought I would have seen. I thought naively, right, that this was from the past, but it's not. And so these narratives tend to perpetuate the precarity of many immigrant communities. And so in some cases, the narratives are moderated by us humans, right? And in some cases now they're moderated by algorithms. Ultimately, though, I think that there are human decisions behind the type of narratives that we push, right? Even within the algorithms, there are human decisions in the design of the particular medium. So there's a lot of power that comes with the narratives that are out there in all different kinds of media and the way we are responding, the way we see immigrants, whether as neighbors or as criminals.
What would you say are the most common misconceptions about new arrivals in the United States, not just Latin American migrants, because as you say, it's not monolithic, but the people who are arriving here now in this moment, misconceptions that you think need to be challenged directly?
I think what we must think about at this point, it's to actually return that question, right, to our listeners and ask them to think about Latin Americans and reflect on what you think Latin Americans are. Who do you think they are? How do you think about them, right? And so I would actually ask everyone listening to challenge whatever assumption, whatever notion you have about Latin Americans, because I think that's a very important first step that we need to take before getting into action, right? And so you'll see, one, that we are not a monolith. We are workers, just like everybody else. We're not here to steal jobs. We have complex lives. We have autonomy. We have dreams and families and goals, right? Like everybody else. So yeah, my invitation would be to people to, you know, rethink about, okay, what do I think when I think about this group of people? And then figure out whether that notion is correct or not.
I have to believe it must be really a difficult challenge to balance adaptation against preserving language, culture, and a sense of belonging. How do all those factors come into play for somebody who's newly arrived here and trying to work themselves into society at large, but also remember where they're from, what they're about, what their traditions are, and to continue to practice them?
Yes, it's a challenge. So there are two notions. So one is the idea of integration and adapting, and the other one is, you know, preserving, right? So in terms of integration and adaptation, there is always this expectation, right, that immigrants assimilate and integrate. But it's expected not to do in our own terms. It's expected that a community who is living under precarious circumstances, in many cases, trying to cover basic needs, goes a step ahead and reach out, right? And so, for example, this panel that we're talking about today, it's an example of that. We are immigrants, organized by a group of immigrants, right? And the panels are immigrants, and we are doing the emotional, intellectual, and actual labor of reaching out and saying, hey, look, we're humans, we are people, we are here. Here are some ways you can understand us, right? To me, the ideal integration, the ideal assimilation would be the opposite, where local communities, government, civil society organizations reach out to immigrants and invite us to the table and listen and support and allow us to be part of the decision-making. So often in my research, I found that marginalized communities tend to not necessarily be part of a system that doesn't respect them or acknowledge them as full humans with intelligence and agency. So that takes too much of an effort or too much. It's in some cases, it's re-victimizing yourself or re-traumatizing yourself to try to belong to a system, right? And so sometimes they don't want to be part of the system, and it would be better if we support the already existing organization, because this is what happens. Immigrant communities, they organize themselves, they self-organize, right? And so that's where we go to the idea of keeping true to their original values and cultures. Immigrants and marginalized communities engage in a series of practices that have to do with self-protecting, self-preserving, and even in some cases, subversive practice, right? To use whatever resources we have at hand to create our own alternative ways of addressing our needs without necessarily engaging with the official systems, because the official systems are not that welcoming, right? And so these type of organizations and ways to help each other, is they're not that visible, but they are there to address this balance that you're talking about between adapting and preserving language and culture organizations. Some of them are formal, like Casa de la Cultura, like FLACA, right? And some of them are not normal. They're not visible. We're not seeing them. An example of this can be the diasporic relationships that we often have with our loved ones, right? So that means we create these communities of Hondurans here or Central Americans here, but we also keep in touch with our families back home, right? So that's one way, and those are usually supported by information technology. But the other way is, for example, with alternative ways of doing businesses, alternative ways of saving money. So one of them, for example, could be tandas. I don't know how familiar we are with those, but these are rotating savings and credit associations that people have. They're informal. And so in tandas, participants contribute a certain amount of money regularly, could be weekly, could be monthly, and then the total pot goes to a particular person within the group. And then they rotate, right? So that helps for expenses, emergency funds, and so on. So in that sense, immigrants and marginalized community overall are very adept, are at conserving language, culture, sense of belonging, and creating these other spaces where they are solving their problems. So that's very interesting.
It's so interesting. It is. Mm-hmm. When this panel discussion takes place at the Kentucky Theater, again, that's going to be on May 28th at 7 p.m., what do you hope the audience looks like?
Oh, my goodness, that's a good question. So preaching to the choir is nice, but actually, I would love to see people not from the choir, right? So we want to reach a people who are not on board. So if you think of yourself an ally, come, but also bring your friend, your relative, your neighbor who might not, you know, be an ally, who might be on the fence about immigrants. We would love to see those who don't necessarily support immigrants. We want them to hear these stories. I would expect them to, however, be, you know, a little bit open to a conversation that might feel uncomfortable for them, but that's part of the process, right? Open to real information directly from the experience of immigrants, from experts. That is information that is not moderated by an algorithm, nothing that you see on social media, right? You have a different experience. And, you know, someone to come with curiosity. So I think I want to say everybody's welcome, but I would be very happy to share my experiences in the panel as well with members of the community who are not super familiar with the struggle of immigrants.
All right. The event is titled South of the Border, 7 p.m. May 28th at the Kentucky Theater. We've been talking with Fatima Espinoza-Vasquez, assistant professor in the School of Information Science at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much, Fatima.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. When people hear the phrase free roaming horses, they might picture something romantic or wild. But in eastern Kentucky, the reality is more complicated than that. Domestic horses, some abandoned, some periodically reclaimed, some born on the mountain and never handled, living in difficult conditions that raise questions about animal welfare, public safety, and responsibility. And they are questions Lori Redmond thinks about all the time. Lori is equine director for the Kentucky Humane Society. She's here to talk to us about this. Welcome, Lori.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And so when people hear that phrase, free roaming horses, they might imagine something beautiful, something natural. But what do you want them to understand first about the reality of these horses in eastern Kentucky?
Well, first of all, there are some areas, some abandoned mine sites where grass is plentiful, the population is smaller, and the horses are beautiful, and the landscape is beautiful. However, there are others, many, in which the number of horses has outstripped the environment's abilities to sustain them, and you see horses that are struggling, that are thin, or just limping, not doing well, some inbreeding that causes some poorly failure to thrive in some babies and that type of thing. So it's kind of a mixed bag, and we're here to help the ones that need the help in terms of that are struggling with and able to survive out there.
I've heard of this being an issue in Breathitt County, but I take it it's in many more counties in the area.
It is. There are 7 counties in Kentucky that we are aware of that have free roaming horses on mine sites. And then it also goes over into West Virginia. And there are several counties in West Virginia that also have those horses. And within those counties, there are several sites that are the abandoned mine sites within that county.
I know that you draw an important distinction between wild horses and domestic horses that have been turned loose. Why does that distinction matter so much in how the public understands this situation?
So the difference between wild horses and the horses we see on mine sites in eastern Kentucky is the number of generations that they've been out there and been on their own. The horses out west, you may see that they you'll have to really struggle to get close to them or maybe photograph them with a telephoto lens. And the horses here will come a lot closer. And so they are fed by people that ATV up there. There's a lot of adventure tourism in the area. So they oftentimes are conditioned to come to the sound of an ATV or a vehicle. And some may even be what we call treat tame, which is they'll take food from your hand or close proximity. But that gives the perception of them being tame when really, if you went to reach for them, they would run away. So they don't have the same sense of self-preservation that the horses do out west. The other thing is that they don't form structured herds like the horses out west because they don't really have that same organizational tendency. Horses that are turned out together might stick together, even if it's a gelding and a mare, a yearling, last year's baby, and then this year's baby in little pods as opposed to larger herds. And then they also don't seem to push out the younger horses that when they're of age that they can be breeding with other horses. So oftentimes there's some inbreeding in there going on. So they don't have the same traditional self-preservation and survival skills that some of the traditionally wild horses do out west.
Now, do I understand correctly that some of these horses are kind of being dumped and left there, and some of these owners are coming back in the spring and picking them up and using them for riding and then bringing them back and dumping them again? Is that actually happening?
That does happen, although I'm seeing it less and less in recent years. So I first started going out and working with this population of horses back in 2013. And a good percentage of them were tame. You can pick them up, ride them, drop them back off. And I'd go up there and you might even see saddle marks on the horse because they'd just been ridden. However, in recent years, I'm seeing more and more horses that truly are feral that are born out there and they've never been handled or ridden at all. So it may just depend on the pockets of where they are, but in the counties that we are currently working right now and spending our time, the vast majority of those have been born out there and never handled. So we call them feral instead of wild.
I know that the Humane Society has a population control program underway. It's a blend of fertility control and rescue and rehoming. And at the center of this is a contraceptive vaccine. How is that working and how challenging is it to give a shot to a horse that doesn't want one?
Actually, this is the implementation of a fertility control program. It's called PZP, which is the name of the vaccine. It is the most exciting thing that's happened to date with these horses, these free-roaming horses, because what it does is it moves us from being reactive, meaning helping horses when they're in crisis or they're ill or injured, and to being proactive by reducing the population before it gets out of hand. So I'm super excited about that. We just started implementing it in 2025, and at a small pilot project in Magoffin County. And now we're moving into 2026 and getting a second season. It will take a little bit of time to determine the effects of this because a lot of these horses, I'd say about 80% of the mares or female horses are pregnant every single year. So the first year we may vaccinate them, but if they are already pregnant, it will not abort the baby. So they'll go ahead and have that baby. So the horses we darted in 2025 went ahead and had a baby. If we didn't catch them before they had the baby and were rebred, which could happen 2 weeks after they have a baby, then they're gonna have a 2026 one. So we have committed to a 3-year project for PZP because it will take a year or two before you'll start seeing some of those results, given the fact that so many are already pregnant and gestation is 11 months for horses. So it's a little bit of a delayed gratification, but we are on track to hopefully make an impact and start seeing some results here either this fall or the beginning of next year.
In the meantime, have you seen examples where intervention, adoption, or community cooperation, for that matter, have made a real difference for particular horses or for herds?
So the pilot project that we did was with a herd in Magoffin County. And we, that first spring of 2025, we do this by dart. You asked about how difficult it is to dart a horse that doesn't want to be darted. It's done through remote delivery through a dart gun. So we don't have to get close enough to actually handle them.
Because a lot of these, the ones that are born in the wild are feral and are not accustomed to human handling, right?
Correct. And then after you do, there's a primer and then there's a booster. So once you do some darting within that herd, let's say there's 20 horses and, 12 of them are females of age to be vaccinated. You dart them, then you come back and you do a booster. And after a while, they're like, whenever these people come around, I get like a bee sting. It's just it's mild. It doesn't hurt them, but it does feel like a fly bite or a bee sting from what I can imagine and from their reactions. And so they'll start moving off and you can't get quite as close. So then you have to get a little bit better shot and, a distance of maybe 30 yards versus 15 or 20 yards. And so it's kind of a science to that. But at that site, unfortunately, there were some horses there that were collected illegally by somebody that wanted to sell them. We darted 36 horses in the spring. And of those, 24 of those were collected by somebody illegally. And they ended up back with us at our farm, but they had to exit the program early in year one because we couldn't track them to see if they were rebred because they weren't exposed to stallions because they were now in captivity. So it kind of put us back a little bit, but we're on track to do a lot, some darting and some great things here in 2026. And those horses are all safe and waiting for their chance at a home. But we won't have the data from that from 2025 as we wanted to with that volume. There are some horses that did not become pregnant that we have marked that. But the sample population, in my opinion, is not large enough to be able to say it's been successful year one or not. So we're kind of starting in 2026 this spring right now with what we're calling year one.
Well, if somebody hears this, Lori, and they would like to bring one of these horses into their life, how can they go about doing that?
So if they've already been caught, like they're at the Kentucky Humane Society right now, they can fill out an adoption application. There's also other organizations. The Appalachian Horse Project has some of these feral horses in their care as well. If they see a horse on a mountaintop and they want that horse, they can't just go up and pick up a horse. They have to go through the same process that we go through for stray holds. So they would have to contact the judge executive in that county, ask to collect the horse and put it on stray hold for 15 days and go through the process of getting a veterinarian to examine it and put it on stray hold with the state vet. And so if they wanted to do all that, they could then, after 15 days, if the owner didn't claim the horse, it would be theirs. But I would probably say that most counties, they're only going to allow you to do that if there's something, is there a reason to collect the horse? It's not because this is a pretty color and I want that horse. Usually we're only collecting because they're in the roads, they are ill or injured, or they're on private property and they're causing some destruction of private property.
All right, that's Lori Redmond. She is equine director for the Kentucky Humane Society. More information on the group's work with free roaming horses in eastern Kentucky is available through the Kentucky Humane Society. And what is that website?
The website is kyhumane.org, and you can /horses will get you to where you want to go.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much, Lori.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
And he comes to her head. But he's not really tame. He longs to be lost. She longs for the same. And he'll bolt and he'll plunge through the first open path.
When the Heedley Whitney Museum of Art on Old Frankfort Pike in Lexington held a Sunday afternoon reception for its latest exhibition about a month ago, it was expected that there would be a good crowd, but nothing like what actually turned out. Overflow parking, crowds moving wide-eyed and delighted from one gallery displaying the works of Lexington's Lynn Sweet to another filled with the art of Louisville's Rodney Hatfield, a.k.a. Art Snake. It's a feast for the eyes, mind, and soul. And here to tell us more is Heedley Whitney Executive Director Christina Bell. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today.
So how did this show come together?
Oh, gosh. Well, Kentucky has an amazing number of artists who are accomplished and internationally known and who live and work here. And one of my goals at the Heedley Whitney Museum is to honor those Kentucky artists who have devoted their life's work, maybe 30 to 50 years even, to creating art. And Rodney Hatfield and Lynn Sweet are certainly two iconic Kentucky artists. I was thrilled to work and collaborate on this exhibit with Frankie York, who represented both Rodney and Lynn for many decades through New Editions Gallery. And together, we were able to gather over 200 Hatfield and Sweet works, both from private collectors and on loan, and newer works, and some of which are even available for purchase, which is slightly unusual and a very good thing. I have known Lynn Sweet for many years and admired his work, and I knew of Rodney's work from way back, like many people, when he first was exhibiting in Alfalfa. And I've just watched him over the years, and in the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years, noticed his work even more and how it had changed. And I knew those two knew each other also. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's...
They're old friends, aren't they?
Old friends from the 70s, met in college. So I thought, this is good. I think this is something that will be, you know, really an honor to them and their 50-year careers as artists and their life's work, and also the connection and the collaboration that they've done with one another over the years.
Well, let's go a little bit more deeply into that for listeners who might not have experienced the works of these artists. If you could tell us briefly about Lynn Sweet and about Rodney Hatfield.
Well, Lynn is multi and supremely talented, as I tell him. And he has been a furniture designer and builder for many years. And his work is just incredible. I've never seen skill and really the design eye as that he has. And he was an instructor at University of Kentucky for many years, 45 years in the art department, and helping both faculty and students with woodwork and design. And he has done that for a very long time, I think recently retired. And he's always been a painter. And he painted abstracts and, of course, landscapes of Kentucky and beyond. And I also knew that he did really exquisite fresco work, which is really unusual to do these days. And then at some point, that became challenging for his thumbs.
And let me just ask you to explain to our listeners what fresco is.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's a process that he uses with pigment and marble dust and paint. And at some point, he learned to put it in a cake piping device and, squeezes it out of the piping, just like you would icing. It's a really interesting process. He'll do parts of it on there and then smooths it all out to a finished product, which adds a lot of depth and intensity of color and, of course, some weight to it also. And so he's going to be speaking about that process at the museum a couple of times coming up in May and June. So he'll explain that more. But it's a beautiful process. He's taken it from the old masters and then sort of changed it to his own way of doing it.
And then that process, actually, it's one of those things, the same thing that makes you rich makes you poor. It eventually affected his hand.
Yes.
So he had to switch. Is that correct?
That is correct. By virtue of the repetitive use of the bag.
Kind of like carpal tunnels.
Yes, and the materials, you know, thick also. And so it did damage his thumbs at some point. And with that, interestingly, he decided he'd try his hand at acrylic and went back to a painting class, which is unbelievable when you see the quality and direction of his work. And he started painting acrylic. Sometimes for me, I have to sort of go up and really look closely or hold them to feel the weight to tell whether it's acrylic or fresco.
Now, Rodney Hatfield, what can you tell us about Rodney?
Oh my gosh. Well, to know him is to love him. He is a character. He is a real Hatfield from the Eastern Kentucky Hatfield and McCoys. Grew up in Eastern Kentucky, and he was creative from a child on. And he said, you know, somebody put a crayon in his hand and he never stopped. He became a musician really first and was in several bands around Lexington, traveled the country. Mm-hmm. Some of you might remember Metropolitan All-Star Blues, Tin Can Buddha, the Hatfield Clan. He went to University of Kentucky, and somewhere in there he began painting in his apartment. He didn't want anyone to see it. He just was shy about that. But his friends finally talked him into showing it. He began showing at Alfalfa's, and that has led to a really established career with his painting. He is exhibited in Santa Fe, in Ecuador, certainly in Kentucky. And his work is really unusual, uninhibited, original, unique characters that he comes to in his own mind and translates to canvas.
I should add here that you can get a sense of this show that we're talking about by visiting undermainarts.org. There's a set of videos of our contributing writer Kevin Nance walking through each gallery with Sweet and Hatfield, and it's interesting to listen to the thoughts of the artists themselves on what you're seeing, so I recommend that. And how long will the show be underway?
The show will be on exhibit until June 28th, and we are open at the Healy Whitney Museum Friday, Saturday, and Sundays from 10 to 4.
I want to switch gears just a little bit. Christina, you're an astute observer of the Lexington art scene, which lately has seemed to be enjoying a lot of energy and a lot of interest. Witness what happened at the reception for Sweet and Hatfield. How would you describe this moment we're in?
Gosh, thrilling and exciting. And I am all about the artist and what they contribute to this community. And it's just really wonderful to see the support, the joy that this brings to people. When people are visiting the museum, I have many, many people say, oh, I just need a moment to be away from everything else and see art and feel the joy of that. And a lot going on in Lexington. It's very exciting, and I'm so glad to see it. I'm glad to be a part of it. And I want to thank Undermain for being a huge contributor to that process and letting the community know, because we don't have very many outlets these days for arts. And I recently learned that the Herald Leader no longer is able to carry the arts or even the weekend best bets. So thank you to Undermain.
Well, that's the reason we do it. Yep. That's the reason. It's because that's the kind of community we want to live in.
Yes.
Christina, you and I were talking about the Charlie Harper exhibit, and this is a point that I think that we need to make repeatedly, and that is the literal value that arts bring to Lexington as a destination. The Charlie Harper exhibit was your previous show. Tell us what happened as a result of that. Who came here to see that?
Amazing. Yes, we had the Charlie Harper exhibit at the Healy Whitney beginning last April. It was so wildly popular that we were able to extend it all the way to the end of November. And what we started noticing right away was that people were coming from all over the country. And we quickly began writing down the states. We would ask people as soon as they came in, and someone would come in from, we're from Oklahoma. And I'd say, Are you just passing through? No, we got in the car and came specifically to Lexington for this exhibit. Never been to Lexington before. Never heard of Healy Whitney. Big fans of Charlie Harper. So we counted in all till 40 different states and over 8,000 visitors. And, you know, when they come here, they're staying. They stay overnight. They go to hotels. They dine. They shop. And certainly they ask about other art galleries in town. What else can we see? Other attractions. And that is nothing but good for this city and this community, not to mention, you know, for the artists. So I was thrilled about that. I, at some point, sort of wondered, I'm hoping people will know who Charlie Harper is. And they certainly did, all across the country.
Well, I say this lovingly, but we really are about a lot more than just bourbon, basketball, and horses. Nothing against those, but it seems to me that the arts have been left on the table. And I feel like something's changing here.
I think there is a definite palpable shift. And I agree with that. There's a lot more going on. There's the exhibit that's downtown right now.
Mm-hmm. Temporary Monuments.
Yes. I can't wait to get to see that. I was trying to get the one at the Lee Whitney open, so maybe I'll have a moment to come up for air and go see other things. But just, you know, lots of goings on, lots of, I mean, Louis Gart is doing fabulous things.
They are.
A couple of new galleries.
You know, the day of the opening, there were three major art shows going on in this town.
Wow. Say what those were.
The Louis Gart.
Yes.
Quiet Knot.
Yes.
Temporary Monuments downtown, and what used to be Festival Markets now being renovated, and
yes,
they're letting it be used right now by a group that's putting it on there, led by Stuart Horodner and Leah Kolb. And then, of course, the event at Healy Whitney.
Yes.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you have the Lynn Sweet Rodney Hatfield show now underway, running through June 28th. What's in the works after that?
Well, I'm looking at an exhibit in the fall called The Art of Quilts and the Stories They Tell. I find it fascinating that quilts are a real art form. They're beautiful, and I'm really focusing on the stories. And there's a story behind every quilt, usually, and they're very interesting. So that's what I'm looking at sometime in September through November.
It's a chilly time of the year. It's a good time to be thinking about quilts as well for that reason.
Pumpkin spice, hay rides, and quilts. And
absolutely. Yep. Christina Bell, Executive Director of the Healy Whitney Museum of Art. Thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.